Thank you very much, Terry, for having me on the show. Before I get into the details of Phoenix, I thought I'd give a little history, how America even got to Vietnam in the first place. It was after World War II, and the Vietnamese, under leadership of Ho Chi Minh and General Giap, fought the French, and Vietnam had been a French colony for many decades. And by 1954, they had effectively defeated the French. And there was a big international conference, and the Soviet Union and the Chinese, United States, France, and Britain decided to divide Vietnam in half. And the northern half went to the nationalists, to Ho Chi Minh and the people who were fighting the French, and the South Vietnam became a republic, and the United States basically took over from France, administering all the military, political, and civic institutions that the French had set up over decades. And in 1955, the United States arranged for a Catholic named Diem to become president of Vietnam. And for the next, until 1963, Diem and this very small Catholic clique, Diem was a Catholic, in a country that was 95% Buddhist, led Vietnam in a very authoritarian way, and the Buddhist population really resented it. And over those years, with help from the North, they began an insurgency. And by 1963, the insurgency was basically had conquered most of the South, and only Saigon remained. And so Diem was assassinated, and the CIA and the United States tried to save the situation by appointing a series of Buddhist generals to be president of the country. But the insurgency was so far advanced that in 1965, the United States actually had to start sending troops. And the United States thought that it could defeat the insurgency and its northern backers militarily. But after about 2 years, it became apparent that the people of South Vietnam were so determined to overthrow the United States-backed regime that the only way the United States could continue to control South Vietnam was to absolutely destroy, to eliminate the leadership of the insurgency. And this is where the Phoenix program comes into play. The CIA, the insurgency was called itself the National Liberation Front. And it consisted of it was basically a secret government, a civilian organization, apart from the Viet Cong guerrillas. And they were established in each of the 44 provinces and all of the cities of Vietnam. And they had widespread popular support. And they were effectively a shadow government to the government that the United States was maintaining and had put in place. So the CIA used all the security programs that it was in control of in South Vietnam, in particular their version of the FBI, which was called the Police Special Branch, to try to identify all the members of the resistance in South Vietnam. They issued everybody in the country a national identification card. They had records of every family in South Vietnam, all the people who were in the families, where they lived, where they moved. They set up a network of secret interrogation centers, one secret interrogation center in each province, which were manned by the special branch. The police special branch was like the FBI. And they would drag people into these interrogation centers, and they would ask them to inform on members of the resistance. They would try to turn members of the resistance into double agents. And all the time they were just trying to map out and form a organizational chart of the resistance. And this, the police special branch was one of the two foundation stones of the Phoenix program. The other foundation stone was the CIA's private mercenary army, which were originally called counterterrorists, and were later renamed provincial reconnaissance units. And like the special branch, they were in each province, under CIA control, funded by the CIA. And they would actually go after to capture and bring to these interrogation centers people that they had identified as members of what was called the Viet Cong insurgency, the resistance, which was said to be communist, but was actually nationalist, although there, of course, were a lot of communists involved in it. The National Liberation Front also consisted of a lot of different kind of its own civic organizations. There were the National Liberation Front organized secretly teacher organizations, labor organizations, farmer organizations, of which people were secretly members. And the Phoenix program, when it was instituted in 1967, went after all these people as well. It went after all the members, the clandestine members of the secret government, all of whom were civilians. It was all done under the term pacification. The idea that the only way the CIA and the United States could gain political control of South Vietnam was to absolutely destroy any resistance to its control. This involved, as I mentioned, total surveillance of everybody in South Vietnam to find out whether or not they were members of the secret government or if they supported it through the special branch, which was, again, like an FBI, and then through the programs, the CIA, mostly CIA programs, but also certain military and South Vietnamese military programs. I think there was about 27 of them all together that would actually go out and try to capture, imprison, and assassinate the members of this, what was called the Viet Cong infrastructure. So this went into, this became the Phoenix program in 1967, and it coordinated its activities in every province, in every district in South Vietnam through a system that was based on what were called IOCs, Intelligence Operations Coordination Centers. There was an IOC in every province called a PIOC, a Province Intelligence Operations Coordinating Center. And there was an IOC in every district, of which there were 44 provinces, and there were about 240 districts in South Vietnam. Every district had an IOC as well, a District Intelligence Operations Coordinating Center. Later, Brendan will draw parallels between systems that have been set up in the United States, but this was all very experimental at the time. Each one of these Phoenix Intelligence Operations Coordinating Centers would had a member from, or a couple of members from the special branch, the police special branch, their FBI, which were the people who were running the secret interrogation center. And it had members from all the paramilitary outfits that were going out and trying to capture and then assassinate members who had been identified. So in these IACs, they actually had coordinated, I think, something like 25 or 26 or 27 different agencies of the South Vietnamese government that were involved in pacification. Among these were the Military Security Service, which would be like the military counterintelligence people. It involved programs from the CIA's Revolutionary Development Cadre Program. These were people who roamed around the countryside and were involved in psychological operations to convince people in the in the provinces and the districts and the hamlets and the villages to support the government of South Vietnam, armed propaganda teams, the psychological warfare aspect of the Phoenix program. There were national police field forces. There were combat police, regular United States military units would get involved in Phoenix operations. When a village was identified as being pro-Viet Cong, American military units would surround the village. And this is what happened in My Lai as well. And once they had secured the area around the village, then the Phoenix forces would go into the village and interrogate people and try to turn people into double agents and try to establish the presence of the government there. There's really quite a bit of that's happening. And the file system that eventually that the Phoenix program was centered in Saigon, where there was a Phoenix directorate. And as I said, it had offices in every province and every district. And in Saigon, it had a computer system that was set up, which was one of the American innovations of waging counterinsurgency and pacification and counterterrorism. And all the information that was contained in the police special branch files, the FBI files, so to speak, was put into these computers, the Phoenix computer, which became the model for many of the police and anti-terror systems that the United States is using nowadays. But everything was computerized, and based on the computer records, the big brains at the Phoenix Directorate in Saigon actually started keeping score of how well they were doing in their war against the resistance, the civilians who were leading the resistance. And individual Phoenix coordinators, the people who ran the province and district intelligence operation centers, were given quotas for the number of members of the resistance that they had to, quote, neutralize. This led to all sorts of corruption in the program and abuses. As this Phoenix dragnet was spread all over South Vietnam, corrupt officials started blackmailing innocent people. If you don't give me, you know, a certain amount of money every month, if you don't send your daughter to my office, your name is going to go on the Phoenix blacklist in Saigon, and one of the you're either going to end up in a special branch interrogation center being tortured to death, or one of these provincial reconnaissance units teams is going to be sent out, and they're going to kill you and everybody in your family. So the whole, eventually, although the Phoenix program under the CIA's guidance, and it was in existence from 1967 until 1975. Although it was successful in some ways in terms of identifying members of the resistance and assassinating probably 40,000 of them and putting hundreds of thousands of them in prisons and in detention centers. I should add, and it's very important, that legally the Phoenix program hung on the administrative detention nail. The idea that if all these people in the resistance were guilty of offenses against national security, when they were captured and brought into an interrogation center, they had no right to an attorney. They had no right to see evidence that was brought against them. They were simply at the mercy of the CIA and the security forces under its control. There were approximately 4 military tribunals in South Vietnam that would try these people, the ones who survived interrogation or assassination attempts. And these people were, through these administrative detention rules, was all sent to prison. Not one of them, I don't think, ever was found to be innocent. In other words, once you were a suspect, once an informant had identified you as a member of the resistance, you were finished. And there were millions of informants ranging all over South Vietnam who were also making a lot of money off the program through corruption, fingering people who were innocent, turning in actual members of the loyal members of the government, so that the whole thing became just this huge orgy of killing and terror, in summing this up, say was the whole idea of terrorizing the people of South Vietnam into submission was the goal of the Phoenix program. This massive dragnet, no legal guarantees through administrative detention laws, torture, assassination, all these things culminated in what the Phoenix program was and why it failed.
Brendan, we've got we're about 20 minutes into the show now, and I was wondering if you could give us an overview of, you wrote an article, Counter Subversion and Security Culture, that draws and kind of expands on what we just heard about the Phoenix Center and your work was how that seems to tie in with what's going on with the fusion centers here in America now. Can you give us some background, please?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that, Terry. So after the terrorist attacks on September 11th, there was a lot of concern with the seeming failure of the federal intelligence community. The issue that got picked up on was the poor level of information sharing across agencies. Whether or not this was in fact the true problem, can be debated. But what can't be debated is this is the problem that the federal government fixated upon and dumped a lot of resources into. So over a decade after 9/11, we now have 78 interagency intelligence centers called fusion centers that are officially recognized by the Department of Homeland Security. Now these centers they got their initial seed money from DHS. They get some continuing funds from DHS. But they're located usually under state police departments or a large municipal police department. So for example, in in Massachusetts, there's the Boston Regional Intelligence Center that's run by the Boston Police Department. There's the Commonwealth Fusion Center that's run by the Massachusetts State Police. In Missouri, there is the Missouri Information and Analysis Center that's run by the Missouri State Police. And then there's the St. Louis Terrorism Early Warning Center, which is run by the St. Louis PD. But it's not just one agency at these fusion centers. They will have a number of state, local, and federal agencies. This will include everyone from municipal cops, corrections, probation, parole, if they're separate departments, the state-level Homeland Security offices, federal Homeland Security, FBI, National Guard is also an important partner as well. So all these agencies come together ostensibly to share intelligence, to connect the dots, to prevent intelligence failure. What happens in practice at fusion centers is a little different. So there isn't enough terrorism in the United States to justify this counterterrorism mission. So fusion centers in practice tend to focus on traditional what you traditionally expect of police, right? So that's crime control, and particularly the type of crime that can cause politicians trouble, which is violent crime. They've also been implicated in the surveillance of lots of political activity, both on the left and the right. And they are supposed to do critical infrastructure protection, which means they coordinate with the private sector to monitor facilities and share information about terrorism, about other threats. On this point, one of the big issues and one of the areas that they've done the most formal political policing has concerns the environmental movement. So there's been lots of in Nebraska, there's been private sector and fusion center personnel working to monitor environmental activists in Pennsylvania. There's been lots of surveillance around anti-fracking activists. So fusion centers raise a whole lot of troubling questions about civil liberties protection in the United States. There's lots of problems with them in terms of they're not terribly accountable, they're not terribly visible, there isn't much public documentation about them. It's difficult to really get solid information about fusion centers.
We're at 25 minutes into the show, meaning we've got about 35 minutes left. Do you see, can you kind of amplify on the similarities in structure a little bit more about that? Between the historic Phoenix and this?
So fusion centers are similar to the PIOCs and DIOCs that Doug laid out from Phoenix in their basic organizational framework. So they are command centers where multiple streams of data kind of collect, and where kind of high-level, where high-level intelligence analysis happens. What's different about Phoenix and fusion centers, and this is a very important difference, is the legal framework they exist in and the kind of wider context. So first, the wider context. So Vietnam was, during, was, as Doug explained, in the middle of a war of national liberation, a civil war. It's a very different environment than the contemporary United States, where the lines of political conflict are not as sharp. What that means for fusion centers is their targets, their targets are unclear. So fusion centers are set up for counterterrorism. They have all this money dumped into them. They get money from state governments that need them to perform useful services. So what they, in practice, end up doing is, sometimes political policing, mostly surveillance for intelligence analysis and surveillance in support of traditional police work. What's important about the legal framework of fusion centers that's different than fusion centers, the PIOX and DIOX of the Phoenix program, is that fusion centers don't actually store any data. And this is the kind of legal trick that allows them to operate in the cracks between state and federal law. So what they do is fusion centers, the state police or the big municipal PD or whoever is the lead agency at the fusion center will broker all these agreements with different agencies. The state, other municipal PDs, Department of Corrections, private security, Amtrak, the National Guard, whomever they can. They'll broker these agreements, they're called memorandums of understanding, where they're allowed to remotely access a certain amount of that agency's records. So what they can then do is tap into data sources from a number of government and private agencies. But this means that they are exempt from specific, there's federal laws, there's state laws of varying strength regarding information protection. This allows them to do what the ACLU calls policy shopping. So they can say, they can decide to follow, or they'll claim to follow whichever law is the weakest, whichever law gives them the most flexibility. This also means it's very hard to determine what they're doing. They will say they don't have any records on people, that they just create products and then, and then send them out. They tap into the sources of other agencies, make an intelligence project, a product, disseminate it, to a wide number of contacts, and unless those documents get leaked to the press or unless they get involved in some serious litigation, they're not going to turn them over. The documents, by and large, are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. They've created these new ambiguous classifications called law enforcement sensitive and for official use only. And they won't release them. A lot of the times, however, even if they did release them, it's not, they're not all that interesting. So a lot of people in law enforcement, in domestic intelligence, have a low opinion of fusion centers. I interviewed 75 people in New York and New Jersey. And many times in these interviews, I would hear the term intelligence spam. That what fusion centers were doing was just collating information from the newspapers about, events in the Middle East, about what was happening in the Ukraine, and blasting it out to municipal cops who then delete it when it hits their inbox. At the same time, though, fusion centers will, particularly the crime units within fusion centers will produce very sophisticated intelligence products. So I spent a lot of time doing interviews and observations in the fusion center of the of New Jersey, the New Jersey Regional Operations Intelligence Center. And there you will see intelligence gathering in support of counterinsurgency, Phoenix-style, like operations. So there they will, you know, the targets aren't the National Liberation Front. The targets, by and large, are criminal networks, I suppose, moving drugs. So they will gather up intelligence on a drug network. They'll draw from all their interagency partnerships and, you know, get criminal histories. They will get the records of probation and parole are very valuable to them because probation and parole include the much more information than many other government agencies. They will give you contact information. If someone's a parolee or a probationer, their records with the agency will have where they worked, where they've previously worked, addresses of relatives, friends, significant others. So it allows them to map out, you know, a whole web of connections. They'll also do the Fusion Center in New Jersey, does a lot of wiretaps. They use some of the similar, you know, technologies as the NSA. They don't do the same kind of massive bulk collection, but what they will do is they will get someone's cell phone records and use pretty sophisticated software and, you know, take all the, you know, the cell phone metadata and turn that into a report that tells you, you know, where a person goes, you know, when they sleep, you know, their routine patterns. And this will give them lots of intelligence, you know, because they, you know, a drug operation is like a business, so it's very routine. So by studying, you know, by using a high-powered computer to analyze the, you know, the metadata of your phone, it will tell you, you know, to an experienced narcotics investigator, they will know what phone, they can tell, you know, who's your distribution network, who is your contact in higher up in the distribution ring, and, you know, where you go to sell drugs, to distribute drugs, you know, whatever. So this gives them a lot of intelligence, which they then use to mount operations. So usually this takes the form, they'll do months, sometimes months of intelligence gathering, you know, where various municipal PDs will be going back and forth with the Fusion Center, sending them information, getting information, building up dossiers on people in known groups. After a few months, they'll usually launch an interagency operation where they get, you know, people, state police, federal agencies, usually FBI, ATF, marshals, whomever, a whole bunch of local cops. And early in the morning, they'll go out, they'll execute search warrants, they'll execute arrest warrants, they will, you know, kick down doors and arrest, you know, sometimes hundreds of people, sometimes just dozens, seize thousands of dollars of drugs, and, you know, it's a big victory, ostensibly for law enforcement. So this is, you know, in New York and New Jersey, there hasn't been, you know, where I did my research, there hasn't been any, you know, the official DHS fusion centers have not been linked to formal political policing by the media, and I have not, didn't uncover anything in my investigation. But it doesn't take someone, it doesn't take a very active imagination to understand how, you know, this intelligence system could be used for, you know, for dangerous and potentially politically repressive ends. There's been a lot of, you know, there's been examples of lots of surveillance of, you know, of activists. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund got about 4,000 pages of documents out of DHS and FBI and some other agencies in relation to the Occupy crackdown. What they showed was lots of wholesale surveillance, but not a lot of aggressive police operations, not a lot of, really not any active penetration, counter subversion, things that to try to get inside the movement and tear it apart from the inside. So they're gathering a lot of information. Other steps may have been taken at this point. We don't know. But what I can say is that there is a system that in many ways resembles the Phoenix program, or at least resembles the intelligence sharing system that's been put in place. So you have these command posts, where lots of people come together, share information, develop intelligence, try to understand what's going on in their jurisdiction, and then mount sometimes very aggressive operations.
There was an ACLU document that described a camera center in Ferguson. Did you get a chance to look at that? Is that something, can you kind of describe what they're talking about?
So there's 78 of the official DHS fusion centers.
Right.
But there are a lot more fusion center-like real-time crime analysis centers. They're sometimes called county crime analysis centers, camera centers. So the Government Accountability Office did a study where they counted 5 different types of fusion centers, and they came up with 268 of them. That only includes federally funded initiatives. So I can tell you in New York State, there's about a dozen other fusion center-like intelligence centers that were not included in that account. So the camera center in Ferguson is an example of one of these fusion center-like, these smaller fusion centers, if you will. And what it is a, it's a place where, a lot of cities today now have closed-circuit TV systems. They are sometimes built and operated by the municipal government. Other times, the municipal government gets private, gets the shopping mall or the hotel or whomever has CCTV to send their feeds to a central location. And they have a command center where all this information comes to and where it can be monitored in real time. So this will be used for many different purposes. I can tell you I was in one upstate New York City, and I saw one of these CCTV centers. And they would use it, they had an officer there all the time, who would, monitor the cameras. He could control them. He could zoom in. The guy who was showing me around was very excited. He zoomed in on a street corner. He could zoom into the level. You could see whether a coin on the sidewalk was a nickel or a quarter or a dime or whatever. So they'll use that, and they will monitor, areas where there's lots of street crime. They will look for street drug deals, things of that nature. In a situation, in Ferguson with the recent protests after the shooting of Michael Brown, they certainly were using such a system to monitor movements of protests. Protesters and to know where to deploy, deploy police officers, set up roadblocks. Another thing that happened in Ferguson, that's interesting and related and also hard to detect is in you know, circumstances such as this, they will often set up an ad hoc kind of command center. So, you know, when there is a political party convention, so the Republican Republican National Convention, Democratic National Convention, big events like the Super Bowl, they will be designated as a Homeland Security special event. The Secret Service, you know, the agency that protects the president and other notables and polices the counterfeiting of money and has a few other mission areas, they are the lead agency in these events. They will gather up sometimes hundreds of agency reps, create a temporary fusion center to kind of handle intelligence operations for a big event. So when the kind of protests, when the rebellion, if you will, in Ferguson was at its height, the National Guard set up a ad hoc command center in a strip mall at the corner of West Florissant Ave and Lucas Hunt Road. So this was right in the, you know, the right off to the side of the main thoroughfare where most of the protests were going on. So here they had, you know, participation from lots of state and local law enforcement, but also from agencies that you might not think. So Department of Corrections was there, Child Protective Services, and, you know, these agencies are there because they have, because of their unique missions, they often have more comprehensive files on people. So they have, you know, rich repositories of information that can be mined, and insights can be gleaned from there. You can step out a few connections and you can get a lot of information, not just about one person, but about their, you know, their web of associates. So this command center was set up directly across from a facility of Emerson Electric, which is a St. Louis-based Fortune 500, company. Now, this, you know, given the kind of way Homeland Security operates and its kind of, you know, the importance of private sector partnerships, this placement was probably not accidental. This was there to kind of protect what they call in the Homeland Security world, critical infrastructure. So they're there to protect, you know, the outpost of this, of corporate America. Now what was done at this command center was, they, you know, monitored what they call situational awareness, so just keeping a track of the movement of people, you know, about, you know, where people were demonstrating, you know, just the day-to-day events. And then, you know, the kind of the protests, the were kind of controlled by a series of ad hoc mechanisms to kind of block the movement of people. So they would set up checkpoints, roadblocks, you know, control the physical movement of protesters by just deploying lots of police officers. I mean, initially this took the very kind of militarized approach that took a lot of heat. So, you know, the cops in riot gear, smoke grenades, armored personnel carriers. But later, you know, the softer side when the Missouri State Police took over and they had, you know, police officers walking around shaking hands. I mean, this was...
Well, at least in daylight.
Right, yeah. This was also an attempt to, you know, keep protests contained. Not necessarily to stop the protest activity or to violently repress it, to, you know, but to keep it contained, to control the movement of people. They actually set up a free speech zone that was not far from the command center, and they tried to herd people in that direction. And the idea is to kind of control the initial explosion of anger, of energy, and then as the protest drags on, it becomes kind of an image game. So what you see in Ferguson right now is the clergy is playing a rather ambiguous role of trying to mediate between protesters and police, and there's lots of like understandable reasons why people would want to do this. They don't want to see people getting tear gassed. They don't want to see, you know, local-owned businesses, you know, fail because the community is shut down by, street protests for weeks on end. But what this moderating influence does is it operates in the space created by, these intelligence-led policing operations, and kind of help steer the protests to a kind of quiet conclusion. So the protests are continuing, right? They're continuing even now. I would think that they're beginning to lose their momentum in large part because the way the surveillance, intelligence gathering, and the police operations that are being fed by this information gathering are kind of containing, quarantining, and managing the protest.
We've got about 12 minutes left, guys. Doug, are you still with us?
I'm still with you.
In the last 12 minutes, what is your message to Missouri? What do the people need to know about Phoenix?
It's important to know that the government, through its security services, wants to try to control people politically. And certainly the psychological warfare is the main way that this is done, and also through secrecy and not allowing people to know how the government is organizing its security services and how it's exercising its power. So people need to inform themselves so that they can see through the propaganda, the psychological warfare, and so that they know where to go to get information so that they can see what things the government is keeping secret from them about how it organizes itself. Brendan is studying fusion centers, and as he can probably tell you, there aren't a lot of people doing it, but a lot of people should be doing it. They should also be studying and trying to get information about the FBI's joint terrorism task forces, which are really much more, in a sense, representative mm-hmm. of the federal government's efforts to detect terrorism in the United States. The CIA is actually involved in those FBI joint terrorism task forces. I don't know that the CIA actually gets into the fusion centers, which are at a state and local level, because there's very little possibility that foreign agents are going to be operating down at that level, and that's what the CIA is interested in, and that's what the FBI is interested in, are foreign agents having any influence over these kinds of demonstrations, the Occupy movement, or even civil rights demonstrations like in Ferguson back in the days of the Vietnam War. That was always the pretext, was that communists were infiltrating the movement. And therefore the FBI or the CIA had to clandestinely put agents inside the anti-war movement or the civil rights movement because they were afraid that Ford agents were manipulating and guiding these movements. But obviously, that's not a situation that's happening in Ferguson. So there's really no reason for people who are demonstrating for civil rights or to try and make a political statement. There's no reason to be intimidated other than the fact that, and this is the legacy of Phoenix, that the government, in the absence of actually having a terrorist threat, applies the laws and the agencies that it's organized for terrorism to intimidate people politically and to use public order laws and criminal laws in the same way that overseas it uses anti-terrorism laws, or very infrequently in the United States uses its anti-terrorism laws to suppress people. In the United States, the line between criminal offenses and public order offenses and what can be considered terrorist offenses, that line is becoming blurred. And as the country evolves and divisions become more heightened, the government is going to use those kinds of this kind of legal chicanery to more and more suppress legitimate political dissent under the guise of law and order. This and the fusion centers and the joint terrorism task forces and all the other ways that the government is organizing its police and security and military forces are all designed ultimately to do this, to give the government more psychological and legal control over people under all sorts of varying pretexts. And the bureaucracies are so complex and so interwoven that it's a daunting task for people to try and unravel it and learn where they stand within it, and whether or not, if they're at a demonstration in Ferguson and some undercover police officer takes their picture, if even though they're just exercising their First Amendment rights and their rights to assemble, whether their photograph is going to end up in a terrorism database, because that's how criminal offenses get translated into terrorism, and with all these different agencies and all their different intentions all grouped together, these kinds of abuses of the system can occur. So people have to basically, first of all, as they showed in Ferguson, is not be intimidated. But they have to go beyond that, have to become knowledgeable of how the bureaucracies are organized and the language that the bureaucracies use to confabulate and to disguise what their actual intentions are, so that average people can really see clearly what the government is tending to do and where it's going. So, you know, I think that these kind of events at Ferguson, especially for such a worthy cause as justice and racial equality, have to continue. But at the same time, people need to be better informed about the forces that they're confronting, and so that they really understand them and they're not intimidated by them. And people like Brendan are doing a good service providing some of that information.
If I can add something here.
3 minutes left.
To just follow on Doug's,
please.
On Doug's comment. You know, as he was saying in his kind of introductory remarks, how the Phoenix program was very corrupt. you know, and this corruption, you know, involved, you know, involved lots of, you know, life and death matters. You know, fusion centers are also very corrupt. You know, there's a big Senate report released, and you know, DHS told the Senate that they couldn't tell, you know, they couldn't tell the U.S. Senate whether they invested $289 million or $1.4 billion into fusion centers, right? So, you know, and you know, Doug mentioned how the, you know, the bureaucracy is very intertwined. But what that means, what that also means, is that it's very dysfunctional. You know, so at fusion centers, there's a lot of internal strife between people from different agencies. You know, so FBI and DHS don't like each other, and then they compete for mission space, they compete for cases, they compete for money, and the same thing goes with, you know, down on the state level. The state police and the state office or Department of Homeland Security are rivals. And then there's jurisdictional rivalries, county sheriff versus municipal police versus state police. And there's mission rivalries, you know, community supervision, probation and parole sometimes feel that, you know, cops are kind of punitive pig heads, you know, that don't understand how to kind of administer criminal justice. So I say this because, you know, Doug's very right to underscore the importance of psychological warfare. Often these type of institutions, and I would say in the particular case of fusion centers, they have been a more effective in repression for the kind of image they project of a powerful Big Brother state, when in reality they're much more internally divided and conflictive and dysfunctional. So, you know, they may take a picture of you at a demonstration. It could end up in a, you know, in some federal database, or it could get lost in the bureaucracy, right? So to take a, there's a lot of people at fusion centers that are earnest, you know, that they want to stop terrorism, you know, that they believe in their mission, and even with that, they can't do their mission very well, right? So we all remember the Boston bombing, the elder brother, Tamerlane Tsarnaev, you know, Russian intelligence told FBI, you know, about him. There was many warnings about him. Investigators entered his name the wrong way in a database, and that's how he slipped through the cracks. The FBI and the Boston police didn't communicate, and, you know, that's another reason why he slipped through the cracks. So it's important to be aware of these agencies and what their potential is, but it's also important to understand that, like any, you know, organization, you know, it's dysfunctional. And having sat in many, you know, countless hours in meetings of activist groups, of grassroots groups, and having sat in fusion centers interviewing, you know, cops, interviewing, you know, intelligence analysts, interviewing all sorts of people, I can tell you that, you know, that these types of organizations are equally dysfunctional, right? So we shouldn't internalize this idea that the state is after us too strongly, because you know,
that's what they're trying to do,
right? And they have their own problems that undermine their effectiveness. You know, we shouldn't attribute more coherence and more power than they actually possess, right? And that they are, you know, like our own organizations, they're something people made. They can be unmade. They're not perfect.
You made the point that maybe it's overblown, that this is the one thing that knocked out the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying your research is showing, no, this is not an invulnerable enemy. This has weaknesses, lots of weaknesses, and it's something that can be overcome.
And I think here, you know, it's important to, you know, there's an organization called Restore the Force, and they have a they're based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they're trying to run a nationwide campaign to close fusion centers. They organized a National Day of Action to protest fusion centers. They did coordinated demonstrations, but it was relatively small. And they're kind of like an ACLU-type, you know, civil liberties policy advocate. But there's, you know, there's something to be said about multiple forms of political engagement and political participation. You know, I'm a sociologist by training. I know that disruptive protests often yield the most farthest reaching results. You know, that they shock and scare the political system into movement. But that said, it's important also to support and you know, these targeted campaigns. So, you know, there's a lot of boring policy wonkish people in organizations like the Campaign to Restore the Digital Fourth and the Electronic Privacy Information Center and the ACLU with good ideas, and if they could be amplified by some grassroots pressure from below and maybe a little disruption, it could you know, it could change things. Fusion centers are very vulnerable. There's a lot of people in Congress that think they're a waste of money. There's a lot of people within law enforcement that think they're that think they're unnecessary. So, you know, I wouldn't. They seem like a relatively permanent fixture of U.S. politics, and they very well may be, but they don't have to be.
Excellent point. We are out of time. This was episode 37 of this was Occupy Interviews, Occupy Phoenix. No game. No joke. And I want to thank Douglas Valentine, author of Phoenix Project, and Brendan McKay. There'll be links up to some of their work. And in the meantime, I want to thank our audience and thank our guests for standing. Thanks a lot, guys. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Terry.